involved in any way with early childhood education realizes that creativity is the working creatively with young children is really the name of the game. In fact, it's near impossible to work effectively with small children without being creative every minute of the day. Fortunately, we in nursery school and kindergarten do not suffer under the tyranny of inflexible curriculum, but rather we are continually conscious of teaching children, not materials. Children who force us to look at them as individuals, each one with different interests, and also each one with different levels of understanding. Some people look upon creativity as a talent. I'd rather think of it as an attitude of mind. The atmosphere in which one grows up, the attitude of the adults around us, the freedom we feel to experiment, to make mistakes, to take risks, all help to determine how creative we become. It's really a way of working, a way of thinking, and a way of living. If we as teachers and parents lack the freedom to create, it's very difficult to provide a creative atmosphere and environment in which children will feel creative. Creativity spans all disciplines. It's not reserved for the arts. Actually, all learning is a creative process. We can never be sure of our children having assimilated any specific knowledge until they have used it in an original and creative way. A child who has learned about shapes uses this knowledge creatively when he recognizes shapes in new and unfamiliar objects. When our 2.5-year-old granddaughters came in to the LA airport and we were on our way to Thousand Oaks one Christmas, one of them looked up on the hillside and said, "Oh, look, Mommy, a triangle." Well, it was a Christmas tree that was all lit up on the mountainside. So I said to myself, she has really assimilated the concept of triangle. She has used that knowledge in a creative way. Now, the child who has learned about carnivorous and omnivorous animals uses this knowledge creatively when he goes to the zoo and he recognizes on his own that the zebra, the giraffe, and the elephant must be grazing or herbivorous animals since they have hoofs instead of claws. The cat animals with claws are obviously the ones who are equipped to catch other animals for food, so they'd be classed as carnivorous animals. Creativity is involved in seeing relationships in any way that they use their own thinking process to come to conclusions is a creative thing. We had an interesting experience in our lab school one day after we had been talking about this very thing, this business of some animals having claws and some having hooves and some being the primates and eating both meat and grazing, or herbs, vegetables, what have you. We had these pictures of different kinds of animals on the bulletin board, and one of the little boys said, "You know, wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws?" And I said, "Yes, and what else?" "Well, if a tiger had hoofs." And then the little girl beside him said, "And a pig had paws." And I said, "Well, what have you done? You made up a poem. Wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws, if a tiger had hoofs, if a pig had paws?" And out of that, we said it until we got some real rhythm into it, and pretty soon a melody emerged. And the song that resulted from this experience was, "Wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws, if a tiger had hoofs, if a pig had paws? Oh my, oh me, what a mix-up it would be if a squirrel lived in the ocean and a seal lived in a tree." And that was naturally one of their favorite songs. And I'm hoping that in January I'm publishing a little, is she your aunt? Cousin. Her cousin is my publisher. Isn't that interesting? Although we didn't know each other until, we didn't know this until...
She brought us Catherine that way.
Yeah, she really... she's aiming for January, hoping to get my little music and idea book published then. And that is going to be the first song. It's going to... The book is going to be called Let's Begin with a Song. And I'm hoping that... like I say, that it will be out by January. And then one day we like to take nature walks different in during the different seasons, as the different seasons come on, and we like to take them along the same path to see the changes that have taken place. And one of our favorite paths was along a little stream on the Augustana campus, and on one side it was just a woodsy place, and the path was along the stream between the woods and the stream. And at that particular time, the leaves on the trees were just brilliant green. They were just coming out, and one of the little boys, really one of my little toughies, said, "Oh, Mrs. Edmund, look at these trees. They're all smiling at us." Mm-hmm. And so the thing of it is, when we hear something refreshing and original, an expression like this, we should recognize it immediately and let the children know you like to hear expressions like that and make something over it. Then when they think of unusual ways to express themselves, they'll come right out with it, not have to wonder, will she like it or won't she? But this too became a part of a song about the smiling trees. Then one day we had, I like to stimulate interests in different areas by using my bulletin board, because it's the first thing they look in the morning. Of course, if you don't change your bulletin boards frequently, nobody's going to look at them. So we changed our boards very frequently, and they always looked to see if there were any new things on the bulletin board. And one lovely March day, we put up a picture of a little boy with his hand up here, sandwich in this hand, and we just strung a string from the hand up onto the rest of the bulletin board and put a kite at the end of the string, a paper kite that we just drew a smiling face on. And one of the little girls said, "Oh, how come that kite is smiling?" And I said, "Well, how would you feel if you were flying in the sky on a day like this?" She admitted she'd probably be smiling too. So I said, "Why don't we all pretend we're kites and take an imaginary flight?" And so they all closed their eyes, and I said, "When you come back from your trip, open your eyes, and then I know you're back, and then we'll talk about it." So they closed their eyes, and if you know four-year-olds, you know what imaginations mm-hmm. they have. And when they started opening their eyes and telling their story, I said, "Well, what happened?" Well, one of them said, "I passed some birds." And I said, "Did you say anything to the birds, or did the birds say anything to you?" "No, I just said, what a beautiful day to fly." And so that became a song too. "If I were a kite flying through the air, up in the sky so high, passing the birds, I'd whisper hello, it's a beautiful day to fly." But you never know if you expect original things to happen, or something delightful to happen. It usually does. If you work with children with this constant expectancy, you'll get it. Because you are ready to respond the minute you hear it. And that's what they need. They need this affirmation that when they have done or said something that has that creative spark, It's reaffirmed. And one day a little boy came in, and it had just snowed, and he said, "You know, I saw a bunny running across the yards so fast that his little feet were just twinkling." I mean, just, it's children that think of these things, that and if we just write them down, it's their heart to remember. But I'll carry a little file card in my blouse pocket so that I can write those things down as they happen. Positive reinforcement is the thing that encourages children to repeat a performance. I had a good friend, well, he's still a good friend. He's now the director of the Minneapolis Opera Company, or the Minnesota Opera Company, and at that time he played with the Minneapolis Symphony. And he would come to Iowa City each year, and the next evening they played Iowa City, and then the next evening they'd play in Burlington, Iowa, which was not far away, and we lived just 60 miles from Iowa City. So he would come to our house after the Iowa City Symphony concert and stay with us so that he could visit with me, with the children at our nursery school. And this particular day, because he was one of these creative guys that saw and heard things that people wouldn't think anything of, but he would catch them just listening to the children. And he played for everything them. He's a fantastic pianist. He comes up to Holden. Well, he and I have created a lot of the songs that together that you find in our songbooks. And he played the piano. Well, first of all, he played so they could paint. And they listened to the music and painted what the music suggested to them. Then he asked me if I would tell them a nursery story. We hadn't talked about this. He said, just any nursery story. So I think it was the Three Bears that I told that day. And then he played the embellishments on the piano. And of course, whenever the father bear talked, or the papa bear talked, it was way down here, and the little baby bear is up here. And and then he played so they could dance. And then he played them a little concert. And he ended the concert with one of these wild numbers that you play with your elbows and your arms and the flat of your hand, you know, real terribly modern and dissonant. And when he got through, after each number, he had them tell about the word pictures that the pictures they saw in their mind as they listened to the music. And I thought, oh, what are they going to say about this one? I was afraid they'd say something that would embarrass us. He said, I saw a man trying to find his way in the dark. That's a wonderful interpretation of that number. And another thing I like to do when I'm working with children, and we're going to introduce a new concept or a new thing, I like to say, what would you call it? Before I gave them the regular name. For instance, we were talking about shapes. And we'd learned the triangle, the circle. We had learned the square and the rectangle. And now I brought the oval out. So I said, now, what do you suppose this is called? And it's David Marlin, and one of the boys said, you know, I think that must be a round tangle. And I don't know if you've heard Jack Ledbetter's poem, but he swiped that from us. Uh-huh. He, in his one of his poems, he uses the word roundtangular. And then when we're talking about the foot ruler, and I told him a story about how it began and all, and then after we got through talking about that, and they were talking about what things they were going to measure in the room and all with that ruler, I just showed them the yardstick, and I said, what do you suppose this is called? And one of them said, well, if that's the foot, this must be the body. They never say, I don't know, you know. I mean, they always have something to suggest. And I think, you know, we have a tendency to tell our children too much. We just so interested in giving them information. But let them conjecture on their own about things before you go ahead and embellish it. Let them take the initiative to infer and to see relationships and get their ideas first. Many times we're confronted with in the upper grades of having to teach skills that the children just don't see any reason for. I mean, they've never needed that skill, so why should they learn it? And you know, that's a good question. And when I was teaching fourth, fifth, and sixth grade music, I was supposed to teach the children something about lines and spaces and notes and time signatures and what have you. Well, I just knew that little 4 and 5 year old boys especially, who had never been exposed to the piano and didn't have a musical home, wouldn't see any sense in this at all. So in order to create a need in them for knowing lines and spaces, we started making up songs of our own. And they soon realized that if you're going to remember the tune that you made up, you better have a way of writing it down. Just like a poem. A poem is hard to remember unless you write it down and you can refer back to it. And you certainly can't pass it on to somebody else if you don't have a way of writing it down. So we started making up, well, we'd make up little four-line limericks first, or lyrics, I mean, first, and then put it to different, to tunes that they suggested. We'd say the poem enough times so they got a rhythm to it. And then pretty soon somebody'd hold up their hand. They'd thought of a tune. They'd stand up and sing their little tune. Well, one time we had a song like this, and one little girl stood up and sang a real nice little waltzy tune to it. And one of the boys said, well, he had a better one, so he had his in march rhythm. So, well, we were going to take a vote. Which one are we going to use, the waltz or the march? And, of course, all the boys voted for the march, and all the girls voted for a waltz, so there was, we just had to do both. Well, you can believe that when they got through, I'd write the notes on the board, and you know, I had one of these five line chalk things that you make staffs with, and then they had their own. I had separate sheets of staff paper so they could copy it, and we wrote one in waltz rhythm and one in 4/4 rhythm, and you can better believe that they knew the difference when they got through writing. I think the boys just wrote the march one and the girls wrote the waltz one, but they saw the reason for learning these how to write notes, how to write songs. And and then we brought them up a few at a time to look at the piano so they could see the notes in relationship to the black and white keys. But the response you get when the child is able to do his own creating and understand why basic principles, where the techniques, in this case, the writing of the notes was very necessary, and they were eager to know how to do it, and they didn't even mind copying the notes and making a songbook of their own. Learning facts may to some children seem uninteresting until they see the necessity of knowing the facts in order to learn something further or create something of their own. We must create a need first, and then the child becomes naturally and inwardly motivated. If any of you are familiar with Margaret Wood, you people from Seattle or Tacoma should be anyway. Pacific University, I think, is her. Is there a school by the name of Pacific University? It's Pacific.
Yeah, Pacific Lutheran.
Pacific what?
No, Pacific Lutheran.
No, not PLU. This particular school is in Tacoma, and Margaret Wood, I don't know what the name of it is, but Margaret Wood teaches there. And she has for many, many years given workshops in and demonstrations in the creative teaching, and she'll tackle anything from a creative point of view. The first time I heard her was in Moline, Illinois, and she had a group of fifth graders, I think it was, about a dozen of them, and she was teaching a spelling lesson in a creative way. And I was just amazed at the results she got from the way she approached it, through the meaning of the word, using the word, choosing the word they wanted, and, you know, that sort of thing. And at the National Conference for the Education of Young Children in Atlanta a year ago, last November, she was there, and my publisher had given me some copies of my file to hand out to people who taught in teachers' colleges or taught student teachers. So when I saw Margaret Wood, I thought, I think I'll give Margaret Wood one of these boxes. And I went up to her and introduced myself and offered her the box. And she says, "Have you had breakfast yet?" And I said, "No." She says, "Why don't we have breakfast together?" So I had a chance then to talk to her and ask her how she went about this business of doing this type of demonstration. To me, it's taking a terrible chance to take a dozen children you've never seen before and try to do something creative with them. And she said, "Well, I just asked them to furnish the 11 children at the bottom of the class, and then the top student." And that's the way the people are suggested, are selected. And you couldn't for the life of you figure out which one was the top student when you got through, because she had so completely involved these children who really had difficulty in learning. So every child felt that they had succeeded in this kind of a teaching situation. And it's the same thing with for instance, this, of course, is the type of thing you use in the upper grades. But in the early childhood, in the preschool, for instance, or in the nursery school — I like to call it nursery school rather than preschool, because it isn't preschool, it's really school. In the nursery school, for instance, this of-the-moment teaching is so vital, because the child will need to know how many are going to sit at this table, so we're going to put that many placemats on, or that many napkins, or that many glasses of juice. And they need to know how to count then. And that's a good time for them to develop the desire to learn how many. Actually, the natural curiosity of the young child is the greatest motivating factor of all. And we must do all we can to stimulate it, preserve it, and develop it. Children have just an overwhelming desire to learn. And I think I told this story yesterday of the little boy who had only been in there. It was the first day of nursery school, and he kept following me around, and he hadn't been there probably more than 15 minutes, and the mothers hadn't even cleared out yet. And finally I said, "Stephen, is there something that you want?" He said, "I just want to know how soon we're going to start learning something." There he was in school and hadn't learned a thing yet. Each person learns in his own creative way. The senses are channels for learning, but some learn more readily through some senses than others. Feeling, for instance, is the first sense small babies use, and this often remains the most effective way of learning through the child's life. For instance, feeling the letters, feeling the numbers, quite often will help some children a great deal in learning the numerals or the letters. Another person needs to see, another to hear, while smelling and tasting enhance the ability to assimilate certain learnings. It behooves us as teachers to be creative enough to provide as many sense channels as possible. And whenever I approach a concept or a new area of interest, the first thing I try to do is think of how many ways we can approach that thing we're to learn. Are there pictures? Are there Are there sounds? Are there tastes? Is it something they can hear? Is it something they can taste? Just as many channels of the senses as possible will, if we use them to the greatest advantage, then we're pretty sure that we're going to hit every child in the way he learns the best. Certainly science opens the way for using all five senses in every discipline. Art, you can do all sorts of things in science with art. Literature, music, math, they can all be enhanced when an imaginative teacher uses every sense. It takes imagination and creativity to correlate all the disciplines when we're teaching in one area of interest. Take the subject of turtles, for instance. There are many times children would bring something like a turtle in the morning. And I would have had my day planned, you know, with all the things I thought today we ought to have. And the smartest thing a person can do in a situation like that is scuttle your plans, do turtles, sing turtles, play turtles, read turtle stories, read turtle poems, sing turtle songs. And in order to do that, you can't be thumbing through a lot of books to find what you want, but you need files for these things, so you know exactly where to go to get what you want at that moment. You need a poem file, you need a song file. I just, every time I found a good song, I'd write it on a card, my 4x6, of course, my favorite size. And if that was the day where, if for instance, we had turtles that day, I'd take my turtle song out and put it in my pocket so it was ready when I needed it. We need files for our pictures, and they're best filed flat, narrow shelves, so that you don't have to stack too many pictures in one spot, and then each shelf can be indexed. And then you need not only this kind of a file of your own, and of course this was made purposely so that you can add your own ideas to them, but you need maybe a legal sized filing cabinet would be the best, where you can file articles from magazines and under headings that will help you the most, so that you can find them when you need them. And if we are well organized, usually creative people aren't too well organized, so that you have to force yourself to do this filing bit, and then you know where they are. Creative people need more, you know, a certain discipline in this area than anybody else. But then they're ready at your fingertips, and it's a lot of fun to teach when you know that you have lots of ideas to choose from. You have more ideas than you ever use during that day, and then you know that you'll have a good day. Children need rich sensory experiences as a base. They must not only see, hear, smell, taste, or feel through vivid first-hand sensory impressions, but they must react emotionally. Feel deeply about what they have experienced. If they do, they'll wish to share and communicate this experience to someone else. That's a time for us to have the means available to select an appropriate medium of expression. Then if they achieve a measure of success, their self-confidence will be reinforced and they'll gain new courage to try their skill again. It's our job then as teachers and parents to create the climate of acceptance and appreciation for the child's efforts out of the warmth of our own personalities and understanding of children. We must encourage, rejoice, be sensitive, and openly express satisfaction with the child's efforts. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to brag about everything they do, but we can give an honest affirmative opinion if it is really good. But if it's not good, we can also say, you really worked on that, didn't you? I mean, there are ways of affirming the child's efforts without affirming the product. But if we say that's beautiful for everything they do, then our opinion isn't going to mean much to them. But we can give an honest affirmative opinion if it is really good. But if it's not good, we can also say, you really worked on that, didn't you? I mean, there are ways of affirming the child's efforts without affirming the product. But if we say that's beautiful for everything they do, then our opinion isn't going to mean much to them. I had a list of 65 ways of saying good for you. I found it in the Grade Teacher magazine. It was done by a man from Honolulu. But anybody, if you just sit down and figure out how many ways you can affirm a child's efforts. I remember one of them was, wow, would your mother ever like that? Oh, you'll have to show your parents. You know, these things. These other ways of saying, that's great, I like that. There are many delightful ways, for instance, of approaching a painting experience. I never like to tell children, you know, well, let's all paint a dog today. Because I think that what they paint, they need inner motivation here rather than outward coercion. And so sometimes we'd have, but yet they can't go to the easel with a vacuum. They need some experiences ahead of this so that their mind will be full of pictures. Maybe they could have a little field trip, go to an apple orchard or go to the grocery store or something like that, or the fire station. Then they might paint, but then let them paint what they want to paint. Don't say, well, now paint the fire station or paint a fire truck, but let them just paint. Or a poem, a song, a story. There's many ways we can fill their minds with pictures so that they will have ideas, and they say, well, and so they won't go to the easel and say, well, what should I paint? One of my favorite things is to let them pantomime. And one day we pantomimed bathing a dog. We invited an imaginary big dog into the classroom. He was very, very dirty. And so we had to shampoo him good and be very careful of his eyes. And we remarked about his long, fluffy tail and his big ears. And the whole time they were imagining what this dog was like. Of course, you can't do this with more than 6 or 8 children. And then when they got him all sudsy, then we just took some nice clear water, and imaginary water, of course, and poured over him to wash out the suds. And when we got through doing this, one of them said, "Stand back, he's going to shake." And then, of course, they dried him good, and we tied him outside in the sunshine so he wouldn't go roll around in the dirt like dogs always do when you get through washing them. And then they just helped themselves to paint and went to an easel. Of course, put their little shirt, daddy shirts on backwards for their smock. And you know, every child painted a dog. And I didn't tell anybody to paint a dog. They painted it because their mind was full of dog pictures. And later on that day, one of the little girls came to me and said, "Tomorrow, can we invite a snake?" I could tell she was afraid of snakes, but she was ready to take her chance with an imaginary. When children paint, let them express what they want to about the picture. They may not want to even talk about it. But if you come along and look at it, you don't have to say anything. Just stand there, and they'll usually say something about it. One little child painted just a delightful picture. And I went on then to see some of the other paintings. I said something about, "Oh, I like that." Just gave them an affirmation as I passed. And when I got back to him, he had painted the whole thing over with brown paint. And I didn't say anything. I just looked at him, and he said, "The picture's behind the wall." He just loved to manipulate the brush. So he just covered the whole picture, and he's kind of sorry he did it, I think. But then he thought, well, that picture's really still there. It's just behind the brown paint. One of the most effective ways we can teach creatively is to prepare the environment and then let the child discover for himself. In fact, that whole philosophy is behind the open classroom, where children go to their own interest centers, and by the things they see in the interest center, they're suddenly inspired to do something there, whether it's a math project, a science project, or maybe a story. Creative Teaching Press has some delightful story starters where children can go and find the start, the beginning, maybe 2 first lines of a story, just to give them a little push with words underneath that they might use in that story. And they can just find their own motivation in these corners. For instance, when I want to teach them the secondary colors, I could stand up there and mix the yellow paint with the blue paint and say, now the blue and the yellow make green. But it's so much more fun to just make blue and yellow paint available to them that morning with their brushes. And then let's see what happens. One time, one little boy got so excited. He painted the yellow and the blue, of course, got them mixed. And he said, "Oh, I discovered green!" And just screamed. And of course, everybody had to run around and see his green. And one of the little girls said, I don't remember whether it was a girl or a boy who discovered the green. But anyway, that was the reaction. And then one of the little children who was standing there looking at the grain said, looked up at me and said, "He must be a professor. He discovered grain." A precious commodity we occasionally find in the young child is a refreshing sense of humor. Creative humor can turn a tense moment into laughter. We're really blessed if we have a child with this terrific spark. The one who stands out in the... Yes?
I was going to ask you, how do you discipline a child with that creative spark? I've got one. It is tough to discipline that particular child.
You mean they're too funny?
No, she can find the humor in absolutely any situation.
Well, don't squelch it.
Yeah.
Why should you discipline her?
Keep her alive. We've been discussing this, Doris, for 3 days.
Yeah.
Why should we discipline her?
Well, I mean, the humor itself shouldn't be squelched.
Right.
Or something
right.
that... A consequence of the humor right. should be squelched, but the humor itself is just too precious a commodity.
It's during the disciplinary session that she invariably find the humorous whatever it was. Therein lies the problem. No, I wouldn't squelch this creative because this is delightful.
Just don't laugh.
But boy, is it hard not to
laugh. Yeah, I can. Yeah. Well, you know, I had a little boy by the name of Mark who... I think he must have had a grandmother living with them or something, because he came through with these old 1920s phrases like, "You're just not whistling Dixie." I heard a conversation between him and one of the other children at Halloween time, and he said, the other boy said, "Well, what are you coming as?" And he said, "A ghost. What do you think, Whistler's mother?" He inadvertently got kicked in the eye and came to me close to tears as I've ever seen him. And I said, "Do you think it's going to turn black and blue?" And he brightened up. He said, "Boy, I hope it does. I'd rather fight than switch." And I came along one day, and to give you an illustration of a rather tense moment, it was before we started talking about black being beautiful, and he was playing a game with a little black boy, and I said, "How are you boys getting along here, you know?" And just to make conversation, and the little black boy said, "I'm black, and my mother says I'm brown." Mark says, "Don't pay any attention to me. I don't know my colors too good. I always got brown and black mixed up." But you know, I met his son.
They don't pay any attention to your mother.
Yeah, right. I saw his mother, Mark's mother, at the one of the football games in the fall. And I said, "How's Mark?" I said, "We miss him so much. That sparkly sense of humor, you know, it's just rare." And I said, "I really miss that. I don't have anybody this year to take his place to, you know, give us all that chuckle and laughter." And she said, "Well, he's not too happy in kindergarten. His teacher thinks he's a smart aleck." Mm-hmm. Isn't that pathetic? Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the, I told her, I said, "Well, you'll just have to make up for it at home then," because to squelch that spontaneous, he just had something funny for everything, and it wasn't smart alecky, it was creative humor. Suggestion, there are so many ways. For instance, nursery rhymes are quite the thing in preschool, usually during September we have nursery rhymes, because this is something familiar, and we try to help the children find the familiar so they won't feel too strange in those first few days. And one of the things we did along with the nursery rhymes, if you were here for Piaget talks about this representational period of four, where children begin to learn that something can stand for something else. Well, block building is representational. They build things out of blocks to stand for other things, and they're terrific about pretend games. They love dress-ups, and they like to wear different kinds of hats and pretend they're something else than they are. And so this is a good way to give them a little start in thinking about the fact that shapes can stand for words, shapes can stand for letters. And one of the things I enjoy doing with the nursery rhymes is, for instance, Little Miss Muffet. The first line, a red circle, can stand for Little Miss Muffet. The next line, sat on a tuffet, a square, gray square, could stand for the tuffet. You put that under, this can be done on flannel graph. And you put the little square under the red circle. That's Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet. Eating her curds and whey, make a little crescent out of the felt, and that can, and put that in below the Little Miss Muffet. Then along came a spider. You can make a black triangle and put it down beside her. And here they get the idea that other things can stand for words. It's just sort of a pre-reading exercise. And then they can do it themselves. And you can do this to most of the nursery rhymes, because each line usually has one noun of some kind that can be used in the representation. I listened to a man in Atlanta at this National Association for the Education of Young Children, his name is Dan Jordan, and he is from the University of Massachusetts and has developed what he calls an ANISA plan. The presupposition of this plan is that every child has a spiritual spark that can take them beyond their normal learning potential, and that spiritual spark, this God-given something that is really the creative aspect of every person's being. And it's rather unusual to hear at a national conference anything that smacks of religion, as his did. When I went on up the coast to visit my daughter at Northampton, Massachusetts, and said, you by any chance know of a man by the name of Dan Jordan? And she said, yes, he lives next door, and he's there coming to dinner tonight. And so I got to talk to him then about this plan, and he's trying so hard to find somebody who will sponsor. It's difficult to find foundations that will sponsor anything that has smacks of religion, you see. So I don't know whether he's found anyone yet. But the next year, then, he talked at in Seattle at the National Conference, so he was invited back. And this time, he talked about the creative process. His whole talk was on teaching in a creative way. And he talked about testing people's ability to create. One of the tests of a creative person is to think about how many ways a brick can be used, or how many ways can a stick be used. What would you use this stick for? Or just any common, ordinary thing. For instance, the children. Here's a block. What can you imagine that block being used as? And I think that this gives us a clue as to how we might converse with our children. You know, when we find something, just say, what could we use this for? What would be a good idea? They'll come up with it, something. And there are all sorts of little games that we can play with our children when we're riding in the car or when we're working with them at home to help them learn how to be innovative in their thinking. As I mentioned when I first started talking, this business of seeing relationships is a creative thinking process. Now I'm going to open this up for comments and ideas. I know all of you have them. And an exchange of ideas, questions, whatever.
I like your idea on atmosphere, and I think that's the key to the whole thing.
Right.
As soon as the child is born, putting him in an atmosphere. And I think the only way that you can influence a child to be creative is to try your best to be creative yourself.
Right. And mm-hmm. That's it. You have to feel the freedom first mm-hmm. before they feel the freedom. Mm-hmm. It has to be that.
And like she said, discipline is a problem. Because
you don't want to squelch.
Right. Society squelches creativity.
Right.
And here you are doing something in the middle, and you have to be careful that you don't put your child in a conflicting situation where they can't cope.
Right.
And that is a constant problem. But then creativity comes from conflict and tension. Mm-hmm. You don't really find any creative product unless there was
right.
this tension of conflict.
Well, that's the world. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the way the world was created, with poles, opposite
right.
poles. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we didn't have that, we'd just be blah. It'd be the dullest place in the world. And that's why another thing is this respect for differences.
Mm-hmm.
If we weren't terribly different and every person wasn't mm-hmm. unique, we could be just terribly bored. With the whole
and your
society.
Children learn intolerance as soon as they step out the front door, and many times before they step out.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so it's a constant battle.
Yeah. How many of you were here? I don't think any of you were here when we were talking about differences that day. I wonder, would you pick up that little Let's Begin the Year file? There's a little song that I made up with just this very thing in mind, to accentuating differences instead of accentuating conformity. It's just done to Skip to Maloo, which is sort of my favorite nursery rhyme song. And this is another thing. You can make up songs to suit any situation without being terribly talented in doing this. It really doesn't take talent. It just, if you have a need for a certain kind of a song, just pick a tune from the nursery rhymes and make it up. Some of them don't have to even rhyme. They just, you repeat the first line three times and then end it with a short line. This one is to Skip to Maloo. What if all flowers were small and blue? What if all birds sang the same song too? What if your friends looked just like you? What a dull world this would be. I'm glad that the flowers are different each one. I'm glad that the birds sing their own little song. If we don't look alike, we know that's not wrong. It's fun to be different, you see. And then there are games you can play where you just say, you try to think of all the ways you're different from your partner. And it's the same way with
appropriate games, as it is with appropriate songs. If you don't have one, make one up. Just use the standard circle formation with one in the center, and for instance, we have this little game of beckon, where you stand in the center and beckon to someone, they come up. You can shake hands, you can say, well, my eyes are blue, what color are your eyes? Or, I have a blue coat on, what color is your coat or jacket or blouse? You can make up songs, little question and answer games, to help accentuate almost any learning that needs to take place, or to reaffirm some concept that you're trying to get through. You can play shape games, you can play color games. The fruit basket upset, for instance, is a good pattern for games of different kinds, such as this. But don't just look for ideas in books. Think them up when you need them. You can if you're ready to take a risk. Okay, that's all. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.